Good evening. I'm going to assume that y'all can hear me just fine. Is that true? Yeah, good. So I have a lot on my mind. Not sure where to begin. Although I'm very aware that many of you are at the end of the first day. And I know for me that oftentimes, especially early on in my practice, the end of the first day of retreat can feel a little tired, a little not so sure if this was such a good idea. Feeling like this was the longest day of my life. Feeling. Sitting, walking, wondering, I don't see how this is going to help me. I have like real problems. And this sitting and walking business doesn't seem to go anywhere. So this evening I wanted to talk about, I guess the topic, if there's a topic ever, would be the wisdom of dissatisfaction. That there's something very wise and there's a lot to be learned by opening and noticing this experience of dissatisfaction. And I think this is exactly where the Buddha started. And this is exactly what he came to, was this understanding that being a human, being in this life, in this world, is not easy. It's not what we thought. We don't get what we want sometimes. Sometimes we get what we don't. And so we find ourselves many times in this question of, you know, what is this life for? You know, this kind of deep existential angst. This deep existential, why am I here? What is this for? Dissatisfied question that we seem to never really find the answer to. And so what we're being encouraged to do in this practice is actually to look right at that, to look right at that eyeball to eyeball, rather than trying to look past that for the next thing that's going to feel good, or the next whatever it is for you, job, relationship, car, apartment, right city, right money, right this, right that. Always trying to see beyond that which is right in front of us, that sort of denial. In Buddhism they call it ignorance. I prefer the term denial. So there's a lot to be learned in this wisdom. There's a lot to be understood in the fact that things are unsatisfying, difficult. So to say a little bit of the story, some of you maybe know the story. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it's good to, I find it helpful sometimes to understand the story of the Buddha as a person, as a human being, as he was. And also trying to weave some of these ideas into your story, because you're a human being no different than he was. He lived a long time ago, 2,600 years ago. And he was a very privileged, he grew up in a very privileged culture. His family were rich, wealthy farmers. The story is that he grew up in a palace. So I'm not going to give you the folktale mythology story, I'm going to give you the real story. There are actually no palaces in ancient India, so he could not have grown up in one. They didn't exist. But he grew up in a rich agricultural community, rich farming. And he grew up in the noble class, meaning that he was basically a rich kid of the time. He was privileged. And he was sheltered. His parents were told at the time of his birth that he was either going to be a great warrior, a great leader, a great king, or he was going to be a great saint. And so his father, out of fear that he might become a saint, wanted him to have all the comforts of the world, wanted him to have all of the pleasure, all of the comforts of the world, so that he would be happy. Because he was afraid if he wasn't happy and he didn't find satisfaction in the world, that he might become what he became, the Buddha. And so he, at one point, starts to realize that he comes into contact with an old person and realizes that people get old, a sick person. He sees the reality of birth, old age, sickness, and death. And he, like many of us, is confronted with the idea, the reality that he's actually going to die. He's not going to live forever. And it puts him in this kind of existential crisis of, okay, well, if I'm going to die, if everybody is going to die, what am I doing here, really? Am I just trying to accumulate as much pleasure as possible and avoid pain? That's what everybody else seems to be doing, and nobody seems particularly that happy. And so he leaves home at the age of 28 or 29, and goes out and seeks the spiritual traditions of his time. And I think if we just think about that as the archetype story, I know for me there's many times in my life I felt that way. Being confronted with the reality of not so much old age and sickness, but being introduced and being knowing people close to me, experiencing people very close to me, dying when I was very young, had a tremendous effect on me. It really was very confusing and a lot of loss and a lot of sadness, but also it gave me this sense of looking for something a little bit more out of life. You know, and when we reflect on this experience in your own life, you know, think about the first time, if you can, like, that you knew somebody who died. Somebody close to you, whether with a grandparents or a family member or somebody in your school, neighborhood. You know, just what was that like, just when you, one day this person that you know is alive, and then the next day they're dead. They're gone. And we all know this, everybody knows this, but when we experience the loss and the tragedy oftentimes of death, we know it in a different way, don't we? Right? We all know everybody dies, but when somebody close to us dies, when we experience loss and death, we know it in a different kind of way than we just did in our minds. I remember the first time I was 11 years old, and I had a sister who was older than me, 4 years older than me, who was kind of my hero. You know, and like the Buddha, I grew up in America. I grew up in, you know, I didn't want for much. We had a pool, and we had cable TV, and we had good food. And when I grew up, I had these kinds of things. I didn't want for much. And so when my sister died, my sister was tragically killed in a car accident on the way to school. And I remember sitting down, I remember being in my parents' bedroom and then telling me that my sister was dead. She had died. She'd gotten in an accident a week before and then died a week later. So I had this week of kind of not knowing what was happening. And I couldn't believe it. I was just like, but she was just like, last week we were fighting about like fucking TV channels, you know? She was mad at me because I was taking tapes out of her room and listening to them, and now she's gone, and I'm 11. And I'm just not prepared psychologically, emotionally for this kind of experience. And my parents are not prepared in any way, shape, or form to talk to me about it. And I remember a couple weeks later, they wouldn't let me go to the funeral, they wouldn't let me go to the wake, they wouldn't let me go to any of the ceremonies we have in America. around death, which is, if you've been to a wake in America or a funeral, they're really fucking weird. They dress the person up and make them look like they're not dead, and they put makeup on them, and they put them in this casket with flowers and a nice dress, and they're laid out basically dead in this box, and everybody comes. It's called a wake. It's a horrible thing. And I remember my grandmother encouraging my parents to bring me over there so I could see her one last time. And I remember feeling like not wanting to go. I remember feeling like, I don't want to go see this. I don't know what I'm about to see, but I don't want to see this. And they walk us into the funeral hall, and it's very church-like, very Jesus-like, and there's flowers and nice room, carpeted, clean, and there's this casket, and I go up to the casket, and my sister, my 15-year-old sister, is dead in this box with this, with really nice clothes on and makeup on, and looks like she's resting peacefully. And I remember my grandmother, I'm still angry at my grandmother for this. I remember her leaning down and saying to me, "Doesn't she look good?" And I remember thinking, "No, lady, she looks fucking dead. She looks horrible to me." And I remember at 11 years old being like, "I can't believe that this is the world that I live in." At 11 years old, I had enough of wisdom, enough of inner wisdom, to just completely see through the whole thing and be like, "This is horrifying. She does not look good. And why are we all pretending like she does?" And so, this being a traumatic loss for me, this being a huge part of my life, a huge part of my story, at the same time, it put me in a place where I started to, my view on the world, my perception, the way that I related to other people, the way that I saw people act, changed in a way that from that moment on, I felt like I was seeking for something a little bit beyond or a little bit deeper than the just day-to-day pleasures of life. I remember going back to school and noticing, if you remember being in school, I don't know what it was like for you in school, but when I was a teenager and a preteen, kids are really mean. A lot of bullying. In America, we bully. Saying very mean things, teasing. And I remember going back into school and feeling so raw and so ripped apart. And just the first thing that I remember, I was like, "God, why is everybody so mean?" And I hadn't noticed that before. I hadn't noticed how mean everybody was. And so what happened was I was, for the next, 6 or 7 years, I found myself kind of spun out. And one of the things that I used to do to take refuge, one of the things that I used to do to try to find a sense of safety, and my parents used to get mad at me for it, but my parents left my sister's room, her bedroom. They didn't take her stuff out of there for about 3 years. So it was really kind of weird. Like all her clothes, all of her stuff was just in her room, and no one went in there. And I used to go into her room, and I used to go, and I knew that she kept her tapes under her bed. She had a shoebox full of rock tapes. Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Aerosmith, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, some of these bands. And I would put the headphones on, and she had this boombox, and I would listen. I would just sit in her room for hours and just listen to the music, listen to her music. And that used to make me feel so good. It used to make me feel so safe. I used to take so much refuge in that. I don't know what it was about it, but there was something about the music and something about being in her room and something about kind of knowing I wasn't supposed to be in there. And then also being angry with my parents, like, "Well, if I'm not supposed to be here, why did you leave all her shit in here?" And then at this point, growing very resentful towards my parents, very distrusting towards adults, very distrusting towards my grandparents who said to me, "Doesn't she look good?" I started to get this attitude that adults are liars. Authority figures are liars. And I felt like the world was lying to me. So I became very shut down and very closed off and very much confused and scared in my experience, but also very distrusting of the world and of adults and of culture. And I feel like this is not so different than the experience the Buddha had, where he could tell there was something going on, there was something about life, there was something happening that either people didn't notice, or they didn't want to talk about it, or there was this denial, there was this ignorance. So this went on for many years. And it wasn't until at 19, 8 years after this, at this point I've already started drinking and using drugs and finding refuge in substances and angry heavy metal and punk rock, hardcore music. I was very interested in being angry felt like it was an important, noble thing. I felt like the world deserved to be hated because I was so confused and I was so distrusting that I just had this outward attitude. So I liked angry, hateful, hardcore music, and I liked people who liked that kind of stuff. And then I was in another accident. I was in an accident with a girlfriend that I had known for just a short time, and we were hit by a drunk driver. We were walking in a field on a nice night, and there was a one-way road, kind of like the road down here, and walking down here, and there was a car coming the other way, so we stepped off the road to get out of the way of the car and let the car go by. And the car swerved into the corn and hit me, and I flipped over the car and ran my girlfriend over, and she was killed on impact. And so I came to and discovered the body, another dead body. This time it wasn't in a box with makeup and flowers. It was bleeding, lying on the dirt. Actually, to be honest with you, that felt much more appropriate than the shiny, nice box. It felt more real. And it was at this time, at 19, confused, angry, traumatized once again, that I met my first Dharma teacher, who actually lives in Chiang Mai now, who I got to see last week. And I was very fortunate enough that friends of mine, my one and only friend's parents knew meditation teachers, they knew Dharma teachers. There's a place in America called the Insight Meditation Society. Some of you might have heard of teachers like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg. These are the teachers who started this place. And I went there to meet this teacher, and I remember sitting down with him. They wanted me to meet a Dharma teacher. I didn't have any idea what that meant. I was like, I'll go talk to this guy. I don't care. I'm suffering so much. I'll do anything. And it was at this time that really the worlds collided for me, where getting introduced to the Dharma, really this wisdom of dissatisfaction and being told about the First Noble Truth by a Dharma teacher, by a man who had practiced in Burma as a monk for 13 years, had done intense retreat practice, and was an adult who I felt like for the first time in my life was willing to tell me the truth. And that changed everything for me. Not only was he willing to tell me the truth, but what he said as being true was completely in line with my own direct experience. That in life, suffering is here. Suffering occurs. Suffering is real for everybody. And of course, we know this. You know about suffering. I'm sure you've all suffered. sure some of you suffered today. We know about suffering, but we can know it as a thing that exists and actually not know it at all because of how much we want to avoid it. We pretend like it's not there. Just like my grandmother pretended that my sister looked good. Just like my whole life, I felt like adults were pretending like the truth wasn't true. And I could see from a very young age clearly, there's something going on here. There's something going on in this life. There's something going on inside of me that doesn't feel right, that's painful, and how come nobody wants to fucking talk about it? And I'd waited 8 years for somebody to sit down and say, yeah, that thing that nobody wants to talk about is the core teachings of Buddhism. That the whole practice of the Dharma is for us to acknowledge this idea, to fully embrace it. And when I first heard that, you know, for me, like the idea of Buddhism was like, you know, like going to a Chinese restaurant and getting a fortune cookie and seeing the little fat guy like at the entry point. Like that was all I knew about Buddhism at that point in my life. I had no idea. But I didn't care. And so really what we're talking about here is this Dharma that the Buddha awoke to, the teachings, this truth, this thing that I had inside of me that I could see, that I felt, that I known was true, that no one else seemed to know, and this teacher being like, yes, that's how it is. And so what happened with all the confusion and the anger and the fear, kind of the clouds parted for a moment. And I was like, oh, you mean I'm not crazy? Oh, you mean there's nothing wrong with me? And he's like, no, actually, you are, for good, bad, or otherwise, you have a deep wisdom now about the true nature of things. You have touched in your heart deeply this loss, this sadness, this death, this reality of how it is. And it was like visceral relief. It changed my worldview. It changed how I viewed my life. It gave me a different perspective on what this life is for. And the way that he framed it, it was interesting too, because I had dinner with him the other night. And I asked him the question, I said, that conversation that we had 22 years ago, I actually don't remember any of the words that were exchanged. But I know it was one of the most profound experiences of my life. And I was like, do you remember the conversation at all? Could you give me any? He's like, I don't either. He's like, but this is why the Dharma is so transformative. It doesn't matter what we talked about, what was said. It was what was realized and what was known in that experience. What did I know? And soon after that, hours after that, I learned, he said, well, you know, I said, well, I like what you're saying. It's in line with what I've seen, what you're saying about this loss and this dukkha, it's called is the word in Pali. Dukkha, which means dissatisfaction or stress. It means empty, difficult, actually, is the etymological translation. It's that empty, difficult. You notice life sometimes, it's got that low-grade sense of, you know what I mean, right? Something's just not quite right. And at this point, when I learned mindfulness, I learned the practice that I introduced to you this morning. And so not only did the Dharma offer a view on life, a perspective on life that was agreeable to me that I could verify from my own experience, it also offered a set of tools to overcome that. So it wasn't this dogma. It wasn't dogmatic. It was actually extremely pragmatic. It was like, okay, notice this. You've seen this. You know this is true. Now there's something that you can actually do something about it. You can train your mind. And so just learning that first technique that I now take for granted, just seeing and learning about the mind and learning about attention, and seeing so much that my attention was in my mind all the time, the suffering mind. My sister got killed, and my girlfriend, and people are so mean, and the world is untrustworthy, and adults lie, and the government's for shit, and all the stuff we can come up with about why the world is horrible. I just lived in that proliferation story narrative. I had no idea that that things could be any other way. And then learning that I could actually go into my mind and find attention, this ability I have to pay attention, and drop it down into something like my breath, or my feet on the earth, or the cool breeze on my skin, I could get a moment of release. In that moment of breathing in and breathing out, there was no suffering. All of the story, the loss, all of my past, it's just gone. It's like smoke and mirrors show. Vanished into thin air. Gone. For an in-breath, for an out-breath, and then of course what happens? Back up again. But then out. And I still, to this day, you know, have not mastered that. Mindfulness of breathing, the practice we spent the day doing, I am in no way, shape, or form a master at that practice. But I cannot tell you how many times getting my attention out of my mind has ended suffering for me in a moment. 22 years of just remembering, oh, right, I can get out of here. And so what happens is now we have this whole, you know, other way of approaching experience. I have this whole new way of looking at life, of looking at the world, both internally. You know, I lived my whole life consumed with the external world. You know, and I didn't really get until I was introduced to the Dharma that there was this whole life inside of me. There's this whole inner world of the body, heart, and mind that I have tremendous influence over. I have tremendous influence over my inner life. And again, this was an idea that was very encouraging to me. I liked this type of thinking. I liked this, everything I need is inside of me. The ball's in my court. All of the things that happened to me aren't my fault. I'm not my past. And so as the Buddha leaves home and heads out into the world and practices with all of the spiritual seekers and all the spiritual teachers of his time, much like I did, going around trying to find external, somebody show me something that's going to be valuable to me and not finding it, trying to find it in angry music and not finding it, trying to find it in drugs and alcohol and not finding it, trying to find it in the people who also use drugs and alcohol and not finding much there. He, in his own frustration, realized that nobody was actually going to be able to help him and that he needed to do it on his own. He was dissatisfied with all of the teachings in the world at his time. He was able to do concentration practices and enter deep states of jhana, deep states of bliss, deep contentment of mind. He became a meditation master. But as soon as the meditation got over and he came up off his cushion, he was back to the reality of birth, old age, sickness, and death, and he did not have freedom. And so dissatisfied with what was available to him, and I would say probably in his own frustration, the story is he went and sat beneath a tree, he went and sat beneath the Bodhi tree, and said, I'm not going to get up out of my seat until I figure this shit out. I'm not going anywhere until I figure out what is this dilemma. And so this, even this word Buddha just means to be awake. Instead of Buddhism, I think we should call it wake-up-ism. That would be more appropriately named. And so, you know, when we wake up, or we're trying to wake up, what are we waking up to? Or better yet, what are we waking up from? How are we asleep? And so this practice of mindfulness is how we wake up. And mindfulness as a practice was not taught or practiced prior to the Buddha. He invented it, you could say. And as he sat in his own direct experience, no different than we've been doing all day, to some extent we're all sitting under the tree right now trying to find freedom. He became radically humble, and he had this radically existential approach to what's really happening, really happening. What's happening here? What's going on? And so as he brought mindfulness into this present time experience, he could see what was happening. He could see that his mind or his heart or his consciousness was poisoned, that he suffered because of these poisons of greed, hatred, delusion. Sometimes they're called fires. I like to think of them as poison. And he saw that in his own direct experience, that his body, his nervous system, his heart and mind craved for pleasure, wanted things to be pleasant, wanted things to go his way, wanted to get what he wanted, was greedy, needy, clingy, that he was, his mind was inclined and motivated towards greed for pleasure. He saw this happen. He just sat there and said, it keeps happening. I keep seeing this. And I keep suffering about it. People keep suffering about it. And if you look at the global stage, people are really greedy. Greed is alive and well in the human realm. He also saw clearly that he had hatred and aversion and anger and ill will and hostility towards unpleasant. Pain in the body, emotions in the heart, stress in the mind. And that he was, that we are ruled by this pleasure-pain dichotomy, by greed and hatred. And we're also asleep. We've fallen deeply asleep in the delusion that if we could just accumulate pleasure and get rid of pain, we would be happy. And that's the human strategy for survival. Get pleasure, avoid pain. And he could see how much suffering that caused, not only for himself, but for the whole world. And so he awoke to this, oh, this is how it is. And with mindfulness, he could see, okay, well, this has to be another way. There has to be another way. And he saw that compassion, one of the things that motivated him to even become liberated in the first place was out of compassion for the world. He saw that he could meet his pain, he could meet that which was difficult with compassion instead of hatred. And so in those moments of mindfulness, he could see, I can end suffering for myself right now by bringing compassion towards pain and unpleasantness and all of those types of things. I can care about it. He saw that I can experience pleasure without clinging to it. I can have this appreciation for it. I can learn to enjoy it without becoming attached to it. And he saw that all of these things, what the whole core, the whole underlying principle of the Dharma is what we're really trying to see for ourselves is the reality of impermanence, of change. Everything is changing. Everything is constantly changing. So the grasping for pleasure and pushing away pain doesn't work anyway, because these conditions are rising and falling. And he could see with mindfulness clearly for himself, everything is impermanent. I actually can't have anything. It's so frustrating, isn't it? You can't really have anything. Even you have a delicious plate of food. You get it. When do you have it? You think about it. You walk through. You make the plate just how you like it. You get the stuff you like. And then you have it. And then it's just like an experience. And then it's gone. Have you ever noticed when you have a delicious plate of food or a bowl of ice cream or something that you really like, how unsatisfying the last bite is? It's like, oh, it's gone. And it's gone. And when did you have it? You experienced this temporary pleasant experience. You couldn't have it. You can't. That's why clinging doesn't work. Grasping doesn't work, because we can't really have that. We get so frustrated. We think we can have it. And there's no reason. And because of impermanence, the unpleasant experiences, they go away. I like to think about it as impermanence is always hard at work. Conditions rising and falling, rising and falling, rising and falling. Even that, rising, falling.
What is it?
I think it's a bird.
It's a gecko.
A gecko. Uh-oh. Wow. See, I want the gecko to stop. And so with impermanence, again, this is another thing that we know. You know, this is the easiest aspect of the Dharma to grasp. You know things change. You could go ask anybody, do things change? Oh yeah, things change. We know things change. We know things are impermanent. But how often does the knowing that things change inform the way we act? So we can know this. We can know impermanence. We can know dukkha. We can know things are difficult. We can know things change. But at the same time, this often doesn't make one iota difference in how we live our life. So you can know these things and really not know them at all. You know, also with me, with loss and death, is that even after my sister and my girlfriend, these two traumatic experiences I've had, I still have known a lot of people who have died since then. And it's like, oh yeah, impermanence is still true. It's still here. Loss continues to happen. And it's not until we change our relationship to these things do we stop suffering about them. So on the one hand, on the wisdom hand, mindfulness at least informs us and teaches us and shows us how to see things more clearly. Oh yeah, impermanence. You have some good sits, you have some bad sits. In a 30-minute sit, you might think to yourself, in one moment you might think to yourself, I'm totally meditating right now. I'm totally in the present moment. I'm signing up for this retreat again. Right? You have this attitude, this experience of meditating and just feeling like you're on. And then what, 3 minutes later, your legs start to hurt, it gets a little warm in here, and you're like, ah, this sucks. You go for a walk, it's nice out, it gets good again. Did you notice that? Did you notice the shift? Did you see impermanence? Did you see that? One moment, it's good, and when it's bad, we sit here, we suffer, we make a story up. It's no good, it's too hot in here, they need to have better chairs, whatever reason why this moment is difficult, right? Wherever the blame is. And then we break free from that, we release ourselves from that, we drop back in, and where does it go? It's gone, it's like magic. And then you're back to, I'm pretty good at this. You know, and this is like, you know, we're being asked to see this. So we're being asked to see and to fully know impermanence. And you know this, but we forget. That's why mindfulness, the root of mindfulness is this Pali word, sati, which means to remember or to recognize. To remember, oh, that's right, things change. Oh, that's right, people die. Oh, that's right, there's loss. Oh, that's right, there's dukkha, which ironically in that is the second characteristic. So the Buddha's saying all conditions are impermanent. All conditions are dukkha. All conditions are dissatisfying ultimately because they don't last. And so the whole thread of the mindfulness teachings is always encouraging us to notice. Even the breath, right? Your breathing is the most impermanent thing. It's constantly moving. I mean, you can hold it for a little while, and you can't hold it forever. You'll either give in and breathe out or you'll pass out. So even the momentum of our breath, that's why mindfulness of breathing has so much teaching in it, so much dharma in it, because it's just this impermanent thing. Rising, falling, rising, falling. And we try to bring attention to it, we try to bring awareness to it, and it's not so easy, is it? Sounds like the easiest thing in the world. Just sit down and pay attention to your breath. I'm not asking you to do anything that hard. I'm not asking you to do advanced trigonometry. But what happens when we meditate, one of the things I think the Buddha was so genius about is he brings us right into the direct experience of the Four Noble Truths. He brings us right into the just sitting and just being alive and just being in this body, heart, mind experience. It's difficult, isn't it? There's a French philosopher who says that all human suffering stems from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves. And why do we suffer so much? If things are impermanent, we see that, we see they're difficult. The third piece, the third characteristic, which is the most difficult one to grasp, is that it's not self, it's not personal. Have you experienced this thing yet called yourself? You have a self that you carry around with you everywhere you go? I do. Dragging it around everywhere I go. Here comes myself. Always making some very sarcastic, cynical, not helpful comment about every moment. And so there's so much suffering when we cling, when we become identified by making a story or a narrative about what's happening right now. Sometimes it's called not self. The term is anatta, which means not self. And so this is where, when we can't penetrate these three characteristics, we create a story, we create a fixed self, we create a version of me, the version of Dave, this version. How many versions of you did you experience today? I experienced several. I was just laying up in my bed before walking down here, being like, I have to give an hour-long Dharma talk. I'm not ready for this. I'm not prepared. And I got in touch with the doubtful fear Dave. All of a sudden, that version came online. And I was like, oh, wow, I haven't seen this guy in a while. I was like, oh, this is not me. This is just the conditions of this. There's fear. I have some fear. Maybe I have a little bit of doubt. And what arises out of that is this fixed self that's trying to define me in this moment, to say, okay, you're like this, Dave's like this. And we always take birth in every moment into this different version of ourselves. And we suffer. It's like, and it's an illusion, it's a delusion, but it's such a learned one, it goes back so long, it's hard to not see the self. It's hard to see beyond it. You probably all know about, you all know about the Big Dipper and the stars, right? Have you seen the Big Dipper? Now, if you look at the Big Dipper, all it is like seven stars in a sea of stars. So if you look up at it, it's no big deal. It's just seven little dots. But if somebody points it out to you and says, no, that's the Big Dipper. You see, there's a thing that comes down, and there's a little handle that goes like this. And you go, oh, yeah, I see that. Every time you look up, you see the Big Dipper. It's hard to not see the Big Dipper once you see the Big Dipper. It's hard to not see Dave once I've seen Dave. And I see Dave in every moment. So even though there's all these conditions and there's all these experiences that create this sense of there's a Dave, it's hard to see beyond it. It's hard to just see it as these five aggregates that the Buddha talks about. It's hard to just see the seven dots in the sky because I've created this self. I've created a story. And so what we're being asked to do is to be able to penetrate through that, to see that the story is impermanent. Everything is impermanent. Everything is challenging. Everything is difficult because it's impermanent. And it's not mine. I am not my fault. You are not your fault. We have just taken birth in these human forms, in these human bodies, and we all have memories and experiences, and we all have our traumas and our losses and our relationships that didn't go well. We all have these stories, these things that we've been through. But they don't define us. They don't need to define who and what we are. And so how can we cut through that? How can we see that? And how can we actually, ultimately, how can we care about that? And so this first noble truth, this practice, this not Buddha dogma, a Buddhist pragmatic, suffering occurs. You know suffering occurs. You know, how does it occur? Where does it occur? How can we cut through it? How can we end it? How can we see the impermanent nature of it? How can we see, how can we bring this compassion, which is the other side of the coin? So mindfulness, these mindfulness practices, these awareness practices, they give us a framework so that way we can understand, we can see clearly, oh yeah, big surprise. Oh yeah, things are changing. Wow, things actually really are changing. Like it's not just an idea. It's not just something that I agree with in my head. It's something that I can actually really see. And so as much as the Buddha saw these things, he also said that it's a call to action. The first noble truth is a call to develop compassion or what's called karuna. How do we learn to care about the struggles that we've had? How do we learn to really care about the loss and the sadness and the disappointment? And I think that really we actually do have to learn that skill. We have to learn how to do that. No one ever sat me down when I was a kid and said, you know, Dave, from time to time, things in life aren't going to go your way. Sometimes you're not going to get what you want. You're going to go through a lot of pain and sadness. And you're going to need to develop compassion to manage that. Nobody fucking had that conversation with me. You know, so we all have learned from whatever family, culture, background you have, we've all learned lots of really bad strategies to deal with dukkha. We deny it. We pretend like it's not there. How many problems do you know you have and pretend like they're not there? How well has that worked? We pretend like they're not there. We lie to ourselves. We create a story about how we're a bad person or a victim. Or we create some story that we're unlucky. Nobody understands. We oftentimes feel that there's just parts of us. I know that there's been many times in my life, and even currently, where there's just parts of myself that I just wish weren't there. There's experiences that I have that there's things about me that are true that I just wish weren't true. And so if we can't bring the mindfulness, and if we can't see it and acknowledge it, this first really, I think what we're being asked to do in this practice of the First Noble Truth is to be honest about the difficulties in our life. For real, for real. Just honest, vulnerable, authentic. Like, yeah, man, this is what's really hard for me right now. And to just say it. To just own it. Because you know it anyway. Most of it we know. And when we can draw that out of ourselves, when we can draw that out of our experience, then we can learn this next skill of where's the compassion? How do I learn to care about this? How do I learn to actually hold it? And again, as I said last night, or maybe I said it in Chiang Mai, I don't remember now, herein lies the rub of the Dharma for me, is that we have pain, we have physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain, we have that which hurts. And we're being asked, we're being encouraged, we're being taught to bring compassion to that which hurts. And if we can bring compassion to that which hurts, we don't suffer. We can experience loss, we can experience sadness, we can experience these things and not suffer about them. But it still hurts. The Buddha does not promise this. There's not a practice that ends pain. This is a practice that ends suffering, about pain. And I notice that I get into these like negotiation strategies with my suffering where I'm like, I'll care about you for like a little while. But you better fucking go away eventually because I don't want to feel you. You know, and it's like, at what point do we just actually feel the ouch and go, all right. This is painful and I care. This is painful and I care. This is painful and I care. And it still hurts a little bit. And this is the humility of the Dharma. This is the reality of how it is for all of us. And you can know this, you can see this, you can look right into your own direct experience and verify this for yourself. And so the benefits of the practice, what we get out of this is we get a clear seeing, we get a clear understanding, we get the Dharma really offers us the most elaborate, detailed map. I like to think of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, as a map. here's a map of the human terrain. He's mapped the mind, he's mapped the heart, he's mapped the body. And so as much as we have this map, this Dharma, these teachings, we all have to navigate our own territory. So nobody can do the work for you. Nobody can meditate for you. Nobody can do the work for us. We can do it together in community. We can do it together in a retreat like this. But each of us has to do the work. We have to be able to navigate our territory. And so even like a map, right? We get a map and it has north, south, east, west. It has the streets. It has the stores. It has the building. It gives us a pretty good idea as to what the territory is going to be like, right? But when we get to the territory, the map doesn't have the mosquitoes on it. The map doesn't have the temperature. The map doesn't have the traffic. The map doesn't have the fact that you don't know the fucking language. The map doesn't have all of these things. So as much as we in our minds can understand and grasp and even agree with some of these ideas, some of the way the Buddha's laying this stuff out. But when we come into our own territory, we might find that we have to do some work. And when we come into the territory, oftentimes, if we've been through addiction, suffering, trauma, we find ourselves arriving into a space like this, having a whole load of unattended sorrow and grief that we've not felt or we've avoided. It's like we get stuck in this. We have these two options. We have this map, this new map, and we have a machete and just crazy wild jungle that we have to chop our way through to create a new way, a new path. Or we look over here and we have like the Santa Monica Freeway. It's like five lanes, perfectly paved. We got a nice car. We have the map of greed, hatred, and delusion. We have the biological map of just get pleasure and avoid pain. Don't worry about all this spirituality suffering business. You'll avoid it. You'll get the right job. Don't worry about it. You'll find the right person. You'll get in the right relationship. It'll work out for you. And we want to go down that road, don't we? I know I do sometimes. I want to get in the Porsche and get on the highway and go. I don't want to sit here with this machete and this new map and try to chop out a new way of living. But when we can acknowledge that that other way has not worked, when we can actually see for ourselves the wisdom of dissatisfaction, we can see how these ways and these tendencies have not served us. It provides the fertile ground, it provides the faith and the confidence and the willingness to turn towards all of that which we've been running from. And we're willing to pick up the machete and the map. Say, all right. Because this is a practice, this is a path that is promising everything. It's promising an internal freedom, a freedom of the body, of the heart, of the mind, a freedom that happens inside that's not dependent upon external circumstances. It's not dependent upon where you live or who your boyfriend or girlfriend is or what kind of car you drive or what type of a job you have or all of these self stories we have. It's independent of that. It's an inner freedom. It's a freedom that lasts, that accumulates, that we can take refuge in. And it's just as simple as that willingness to just drop the story and back into the breath like you've done all day. It's that simple. It begins right in that moment. Right? And so this Dharma is available in this moment, only in this moment. Everything you need is inside of you. Everything you need is right here, right in front of you. It's like just lean in and take a bite, right? It's just like right there. But we get pulled away from that. We think, no, maybe it's easier to do this, maybe. And we miss that. what the Buddha woke to when he said, this Dharma I have reached is subtle. It's difficult to see. It's hard to awaken to. It's quiet. It's excellent. So it takes a precision, it takes a practice, it takes a view, it takes a perspective to be able to cut through that and see that, oh, that's right. I'm actually okay right now. And for me over the years, one thing that the Dharma has done for me is I get this overwhelming sense most of the time that life's so, it's okay. It's all okay. Loss, death, it's okay. I could die. I could die tomorrow, that's okay. It's okay. It's this innate sense that, oh yeah, it's difficult, it's challenging, it's emotions I don't want to feel, there's a lot of irritation and aggravation and disappointment, and all that's true. And you know, it's okay. I'm okay. I'll be okay now. Let's just be okay now. And that's what we're looking for. We're not looking for fireworks and this way that the enlightenment has blown up into almost, which is like Buddhist heaven, like we're gonna meditate and arrive in this blissed out state. No, it's not like that. It's very ordinary. It's very subtle. It's very just, it's okay to be alive. It's okay to be here. It's okay to be you. It's okay to be in this body. It's okay that my legs hurt right now. The bell will ring. The meditation will end. It's okay. And for me, if all I ever get out of this practice, if I never get anything more than what I've gotten already, I walk away from the table a winner. For me to be able, with all that I've been through, for me to be able to sit down and close my eyes and in my heart feel like, you know what? It's okay. I wouldn't take all the money in the world. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And I don't always feel that way, and I get tricked and I get pulled back in. And so there's a humility to that. I thought, yeah, it's okay. So I offer this for your reflection, for you to consider these ideas on your own and see if they ring true in your own direct experience. So let's just sit for a minute. So breathing in, breathing out. Just seeing if you can offer yourself some deep gratitude, some appreciation for all of the hard work you've done today. Most people will live their whole life and never spend one day practicing in the way that we have. So we have a short break. There's one more sit. There's one more 30.